This is the D Word podcast, where we talk dementia. Welcome along to another D Word podcast. My guest this week is world-renowned gerontologist, speaker, author, and founder of AgeWave, the US's foremost thought leader on issues relating to an aging population, Ken Ditchwald. I read a blog post by Ken a couple of months ago that pointed out five age-related issues that Biden and Trump need to address, aimed at the US election. Well, now we have a date for an election here in the UK. The points Ken raises are equally relevant. Well, Ken, it's a real pleasure to welcome you as my guest on the D Word. Plenty to talk about. Before we get into what I really want to talk about, can you just kind of give a little introduction into yourself and also AgeWave as well?
Sure. I've had a bit of a kind of an odd journey. I initially went to school to study physics and then became more interested in psychology, particularly the idea that humans had enormous capabilities and most of them were going untapped. But then when I was 24, I was finishing my doctorate in psychology and also completing my first book, a book called Body Mind. I got asked to head up the first preventative health research project with older men and women in the United States. And we called it the SAGE Project, became very successful. We wound up setting up other programs around the world. But then I became really fascinated by aging, which is different than older adults or the elderly. And I began to realize that in the future, this was back in the 1980s, as we saw birth rates declining and longevity increasing, and the post-World War II baby boom, which manifests in many countries around the world, growing older, ultimately, I thought this looks like an age wave to me. And we're not prepared, and this has never happened before in history. In fact, throughout 99% of human history, the average life expectancy at birth has been under 18. Now, people often think that's not possible. So there were 40 and 50 and 60 and 7-year-olds throughout history, but very few. And in fact, 2/3 of all the people who have ever lived past 65 in the entire history of the world are alive today. So this is the new frontier. We often think, well, the new frontier must be technology, AI, it must be new places to live, geopolitics. But in fact, this global aging turns out to have a lot of unanswered questions. Is it a challenge? Is it an opportunity? And so I started a company 38 years ago called AgeWave, and I'm proud to say that over these decades, we've consulted with about half the Fortune 500. We've designed products and services all over the world. We've been doing studies. We just passed 20 billion media impressions on the studies we've done. And also along the way, I've managed to, I've managed to write 19 books and given talks live to about 2.5 million people. And also, last point along the way, you know, I got involved in this field when I was 24, and I'm now 74. So I've spent 50 years in the field, and now have come to realize that, you know, it's not just those older people. I am one of the older people. So I've got a variety of vantage points I've been trying to make sense of.
So you started out, you're now living it in those terms, aren't you? I mean, that you've come up with some amazing statistics already. When I read it, you know, baby boomers turn 70 at a rate of 10,000 a day. Is that's another one that kind of knocked me a bit sideways.
Well, that's in the U.S. Worldwide, it's about 50,000 a day. So some people could argue it's 100,000 a day. So yeah, in the U.S., it's kind of a wild thing because we often think of demographic or population growth coming from more kids being born. The idea that they're really blast off population growth for the rest of our lives is coming because more and more people are growing older. And I also think, Pete, that we're seeing kind of a new age of aging. My wife and I went to see Top Gun about a year ago, and whether you like Tom Cruise or not, he was 59 when he filmed that movie, and you know, he did a lot of his own stunts. And that night I came home from the theater and I looked it up, and when Cocoon came out years before, Wilford Brimley, the little old man, played the lead, if you can try to picture him. He was only 49 years old, you know, and there's Harrison Ford coming back as Indiana Jones at 81, and Martha Stewart on the cover of Sports Illustrated Swimsuit Edition at 81. And you know, I went to see Springsteen about a month ago, and he rocked a sold-out stadium, and he's 74. And, of course, you know, Jagger is just otherworldly. You know, here he is in his ninth decade of life, still packing it in and rocking the room. So what we see is that different than our grandparents or even our moms and dads, we used to think of 60 or 70-year-olds as kind of over the hill. That's all being reshaped right now and reconsidered.
Yeah, you know, I'm a big Willie Nelson fan, and he was 91 recently and still going. So, I know it's only what you say. I mean, I'd seen a little bit of your stuff on LinkedIn again. The first thing that really drew me was this thing, which was five age-related questions issues that Biden and Trump must address. And I thought, well, hey, you know, you've got an election there in the U.S., and I started to read those 5 points and said, we've got a general election at some point this year in the UK. And they are all totally relevant, whether you're here with me or across the pond with you or anywhere else in the world. And I think you've touched on the first one, which was this thing is, what is old? Because another statistic I read from you that I didn't realise, that I've grown up thinking, 60, well, why 65? You know, why do people say 65 and old? And this, evidently, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, comes from the 1880s. And that was a time when the average life expectancy was about 45. And yet we've still got this kind of 65 marker here, haven't we?
Yeah, there was a crazy thing that happened in the 1880s, 90s in Germany. Baron Otto von Bismarck was attempting to craft the first European retirement plan, and he had to pick an age at which people grew old. And as you say, he picked 65, which might have made sense then, but as you say also, the life expectancy on average was only 45. So, you know, Bismarck was a pretty clever actuary. So fast forward to where we are today. If you ask people at what age do you think old age happens now, most people would say 80 or 85. So the first question, you know, and I can go through all five if you like, but the first question that I think any leader in the world needs to reflect on and talk about, and there's some good news and bad news, because we have a lot of pensions and old age benefits tied to an old-fashioned notion of when we get old. So people like the idea that, I'm 70 or 75 and I still don't feel old, but they want to be viewed as old when it comes to getting various safety nets and benefits. And I respect that, and I can appreciate that. But it is a worthy question, which is, when are we old? And, you know, if we look around us, we all know people in their 60s and 70s and 80s who are not really what we'd think of as old. And yet the economies of most nations are tied to a notion of when we're old, which is from 100 years ago. And I happen to be one who believes, Pete, that in the years to come, maybe not this year, but certainly in the next 20, there's going to be some breakthroughs. CRISPR, you know, the ability to recode the cells so that we can maybe write some diseases out of the body. Maybe if we learn more about how to take better care of ourselves, we can match our health spans better to our lifespans. I'm seeing all sorts of new technologies like focus ultrasound. And so I'm a believer that there's a possibility, it's not a guarantee, but that we're going to even grow old more youthfully and live longer in the years to come, which means that this question will have to be asked again and again. The second big concern, and perhaps what caused you to want to do this program in the first place a few years ago, is largely our healthcare system has been oriented for hundreds of years towards eliminating the infectious, contagious bumps and bruises of youth. And that's produced in a sense, this longevity we're seeing now. Antibiotics, polio vaccine, surgical procedures, anesthesiology so that we can do these surgeries. But now we've got longer lived people who have different kinds of health problems. And we haven't really turned all our guns on trying to knock them out. And I would have to say that, in my opinion, and as someone who's been in this field now for 50 years, and as I said, written 19 books, I think the worst of them all is dementia and Alzheimer's. And not the worst, meaning that the people who have this condition are bad people. Very often they're wonderful people. My mother, I've been talking about the need to eliminate Alzheimer's and dementia for 40 years. And unfortunately, not connected to any of my work, but my mom wound up having Alzheimer's, and she kind of got eaten up by it for the last 12 years of her life. My dad died 3 years before the end of her life. She didn't quite understand, where was he? And my brother and I were holding her in our arms when she passed away. So there was a beauty to her end of life, and she was secure, and she was not agitated like some people are who have Alzheimer's. But it was sad. We cared for her, but the great woman that she had been, wonderful woman, great mom, was eaten away. So could we make the diseases of aging kind of our moonshot? And if we address them with the proper vigor and courage, might you and I be talking in 10 or 15 years and they'll say, remember when there used to be a thing called cancer? Do you remember when there used to be a thing called diabetes? What about Alzheimer's? Aren't we glad that that's no longer happening? And that's, in my view, something we all ought to get our politicians and our leaders to not avoid. Part of the problem in the United States right now, as you kind of hinted at, is that we've got two older men running for our leadership position, and they're avoiding everything that has to do with aging. I mean, because they feel like if they bring up, for example, Trump's father had dementia. By the way, Bill Gates' father had dementia. I mean, there's a whole lot of people that have kept this kind of quiet, but we ought to be fighting the diseases of aging and putting them down. Instead, and for good reasons, of course, we focus a lot on the diseases and problems of young people, but we can do both.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
My guest on the podcast this week is Ken Digwold from AgeWave, and we're talking about five age-related issues for politicians to consider.
So first was, what is the new age of old? And I'd like to hear political leaders all over the world reflect on that. And do they feel that they're old? And when do they feel that old will happen in the years to come? Second was, can we do a better job of matching our health spans and brain spans to lifespans? We surely can. The United States, for example, we are 39th in the world when it comes to longevity. Great Britain, it's about 20th. In Great Britain, the life expectancy is about 4 to 5 years higher than it is in the United States. And we spend a ton of money on healthcare. So we might be spending money on it, but we're not getting great results. And the third point is, what about the financial underpinnings of greater longevity? You know, if you thought you'd live 3 or 4 or 5 years after retirement, your pension and your savings would probably go the distance. But today, if people are retiring at 62 or 63 or 64, they might have 20 or 25 years in front of them. And unless people have been very frugal savers or have got a robust pension program, there's going to be a lot of people that are kind of living on thin ice unless we step up kind of financial literacy and empowerment, or even encourage people and remove the ageism so that if people need to or want to work a few more years, Pete, I'm looking at you. You're over 65. I'm over 65. We're still working. By the way, our studies around the world have shown that often people say they like to keep working a bit longer. They just don't want to work as hard, maybe 3 or 4 days a week instead of five, maybe 8 months a year instead of 12, and maybe even try something new. So that's a whole different arena than the world has ever encountered. The idea of 60 and 70-year-olds thinking about being entrepreneurs or teaching school or not work-related, but maybe falling in love again if they've been widowed or divorced. So the idea of reinvention becomes a part of the economics of aging. And I'd like to know that anybody leading any country is willing to remove the barriers to people saving more and working a bit longer. And employers, too, have got to be a little more respectful of older men and women. And that's where a lot of the talent is, too. We're learning now new studies that young people are a little more distressed, a little more psychologically shaken up by the last bunch of years. Older people have a little more resilience. And so there's some assets they bring to the workplace. Fourth, it's going to sound odd, but I think we've got to end ageism. You know, ageism is sort of a young people are attractive and beautiful and wonderful and interesting and cool, and older people are not. So we make fun of them in our advertisements. We portray them as kind of buffoons on television shows. We don't give proper respect in the workforce. If I knew you and hadn't seen you for a while and I said, Pete, you're looking really young today, you'd thank me. But if I said, it's great to see you, boy, you sure look old, you'd be offended. And so we've got ageism baked into all sorts of our culture. And, you know, before the industrial era, older people were revered. You know, think of the barristers in Great Britain still wear white wigs to look old. The idea that youth has been such the hero during the 20th century is being reflected on now. And one of the things we've got to do is, just like racism or sexism or homophobia, this ism is making other people not as good as is tricky and is wrong. And one of the odd ironies of this one is that, you know, I can have trouble with a certain ethnic or racial group, but I'm going to remain what I am for my life. But we're all getting older. So literally the future that we're going to live is being shaped by the prejudices or open-mindednesses we have today. My fifth point, and occasionally I'm asked which of these is the most important. And I started with a list of about 20, and I think all these five are equally important. And I may be wrong, but the fifth one is, so what's the purpose of maturity? In the United States, you know, we have around 70 million retirees, and the average American retiree watched 47 hours of television a week for the last 10 years. And only 24% of our retired population volunteers. So that's a lot of skills and knowledge and wisdom and available time, I call it time affluence, that's not being put to a contributory use. And I think that the most extraordinary growing resource on earth currently is older people. And rather than viewing them, you know, back around in 1900, a Brit named Anthony Trollope wrote a book called The Fixed Period. And it was meant to be kind of a sarcastic book, but it actually created a movement. And the idea of Trollope's book was, is that at the age of 65, people are removed from the workforce because they're no longer of use. And then at 70, they're put to death. And the movie Logan's Run was sort of a knockoff of that. But in that movie, people at the age of 30 were put to death. So this idea that we can't envision any useful purpose for people over 65 or 70 is not because of the 65 and 70-year-olds exactly, It's because we haven't ever confronted this before. This is the new frontier, as I mentioned at the beginning of these five ideas. And I think that our best thinkers and philosophers and contributors and solvers have got to scratch their heads and say, you know, we've got a billion people in the world right now over the age of 60. Well, I'll give you an example. Right before COVID, I spoke at a conference and Harrison Ford was the other speaker. And I never met him before, but we had a meeting after his talk. And at the last moments in his speech, he mentioned that, you know, he's a green activist, whether you agree or disagree. That's important to him. And he said that we got to get all the young people around the world planting trees and save the planet. And he got a standing ovation. So when I had my meeting with him, I said, first of all, it's a pleasure to meet you. I love your movies. You know, you've made a mark on my life. But are you aware that there's a billion people in the world over the age of 60 and nobody's asked them to do anything? Why don't you get them planting some trees? And he said to me, you know, Ken, I've never considered that. And I think that's partly the problem, that we've never really, we thought about older people as being set in their ways, and now they're worn out, and now they're done, and they don't have anything to contribute. And I think that's a big mistake. So before I stop blathering at you and you hit me back with some, what your thoughts are about this, what is the new age of old? I like to have every leader of every, especially the developed nations, reflect on that. Can we do a better job of preventing or eliminating some of the diseases of aging, with dementia and Alzheimer's being that which terrifies people the most, for good reason? Third, can we help people to understand how to be able to finance their longer lives without it seeming like a hardship and making it a part of our thinking? Fourth, can we reach into our marketing, to our media, to our movies, to our discussions around the dinner table? And can we identify ageism and attempt to stop it? And fifth, what's it for? If we're going to be creating long-lived people around the world like never before has happened, what's the best use of them, of us? And I don't mean you got to work hard and you got to, you know, volunteer 50 hours a week, but to have no big ideas, in my view, is unfortunate. Years ago, I wrote my eighth book, a book called Age Wave. And in the final chapter, I said, it's time for a global elder corps. Kind of like the Peace Corps got created to have younger people contribute to the world and add more dimension to their understanding of life. I think that we could do well if we created a global elder corps. People might sign up for 4 hours a week or 2 hours a week, either in their own neighborhood or maybe across the planet somewhere. You know, Doctors Without Borders is a good example of that. But there's a lot of school teachers that could be helping out. There's a lot of coaches. There's a lot of accountants could be teaching young people about money. There's a lot of grandparents that could help younger people who may not have a living grandparent. There's just so much that could be done with our growing older adult population.
Fascinating, Ken. You know, I totally agree, first of all, with the points you made. I guess the thing I come back, you've got your particular problem in the US, as you alluded to, in the fact you've got two people that would be considered in the old bracket, who are holding all the policies, etc. Here in the UK, perhaps not so much the case. But the one thing I think about government is a very short-term thing. You know, people get elected for a few years and then somebody else comes in, or they may get elected again and get two terms in your case. And is that part of the problem, that no one's looking further ahead than 4 or 5 years?
You know, here's how I'll answer that. Maybe 25 years ago, I was asked to have dinner with Lee Kuan Yew, who was the senior minister of Singapore. And what he explained was that you needed to think in terms of 100-year periods. As a leader, you couldn't just think about what can I do this month or this news cycle or even in my period as the leader. So, and by the way, he asked me at dinner to lay out Singapore's future and what should be done about it. And now they've become a country that is pretty advanced with regard to doing a lot of the right things. They have intergenerational communities. They've got exercise clinics and centers around the country for older adults. I mean, they just do all sorts of things that are being done right. And we just discussed it over dinner. And knowing that he wouldn't be around for decades to come, he set them in motion. So part of the wonderfulness about countries like Great Britain or the U.S. is that we reinvigorate our leadership every few years, and we have term limits. The bad news about that is that if they're just focused on getting in a headline today or trying to win votes today, they may be avoiding some of the longer term challenges and opportunities. And so I wouldn't say that, you know, my son lives in Shanghai, and you know, there are parts of the world where people sign up for leadership and they just give the idea that they're going to keep being the leader until the end of their time. And I don't know that that's the better answer, but I do think that we in the media, we in the public eye, we need to get people thinking about these things, and we need to force these leaders to give us their answers. You know, I'd love to see these five questions be on the list of what the media asks anybody running for a leadership role. You know, when do you think people get old anymore? What about continued work? How can we do a better job? Let me give you an example regarding eliminating diseases of aging, and I'll relate it to the leadership. So I was born in 1950. The Salk vaccine came out in the United States in 1953. And since those years, poliomyelitis is not something that we're frightened by on a daily basis. But I, when I was 30, I collaborated on a book with Dr. Jonas Salk. So I was just a kid. He was a luminary. And I said to him over dinner, what were you thinking, you know, when you came out, when you went to work in your lab and you came out with this vaccine? And he said, you know, in the 1940s, when poliomyelitis was rampant, many people thought the answer was more iron lungs. Because there's going to be so many more people with polio, we need to create more of these contraptions for people to be living their life in, you know, lying in a coffin-like thing that breathed for them. He said, no, I think we have to end the disease. And people thought he was nuts. But he had a breakthrough. It wasn't about making money. It was about doing good for the world. And I think of the same thing with diseases like dementia. While I'm respectful of, my mom's had dementia, my wife's mother also had dementia. I am truly respectful of the emphasis on caregiving. And I'm truly fascinated by communities like outside of Amsterdam, where they have a dementia-friendly community. And I think we need to give a lot of love and respect to those people and their caregivers who are grappling with this disease. But if I had one thing that I wanted to get accomplished in this life, I'd love to somehow set ripples in motion so that monies and intelligences were deployed to end the disease, so that we could say, yes, it preys on older minds. It's a terrible scourge. We got to be loving and respectful to the people who are struggling with it, but we got to wipe it out. And that's a matter of thinking outside your own life and even outside your own term. You know, in the States, one of the great stories that people like to tell was how John F. Kennedy, without any good reason, said in one of his speeches, by the end of the decade, we're going to put a man on the moon and return him safely to Earth. And there was not the engineering skills available to do that. There wasn't a real reason to do it other than it was kind of a part of the Cold War competition with Soviet Union. But it happened. So I've been following the breakthroughs that are beginning to happen with regard to new pharmaceuticals or electrical stimulation or focus ultrasound. And I do believe that within a decade, we're going to have the two or three breakthroughs that can either forestall the disease or wipe it out altogether. And won't that be a thing to celebrate?
the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
This is the D Word podcast with my guest, Ken Ditchwald. Oh, yeah, absolutely agree. Amazing. Time to bring it to a close. One thing I do want to pick up on is that you were saying the media are asking questions of our politicians, and it'd be great if they asked those five questions. Doing a little bit here on this radio show, I know you do your bit, but how do you get the media to actually take all this seriously and, you know, start asking those questions?
You know, I'm going to give you an answer that's going to seem like maybe I lost my marbles here, but let me give you the answer. So I know the stats in the United States. When the war ended, World War II, there were 8,000 television sets in America. That's all. It was considered sort of like ham radio. But then over the coming years, it sort of caught on, black and white television particularly, and then color a few years later. And one of the things that happened was that, different than newspapers or radio shows, children were captivated by watching television. And marketers discovered what they referred to as lifetime brand loyalty, which is between the ages of about 15 and 25, people were deciding what kind of toothpaste they were going to use, and they were going to use it for life. What kind of car they might drive, and they would stay with that brand for life. What kind of underwear they preferred, and they would stay with that for life. What kind of shoes they'd wear. And so the whole focus of modern media became, how do we appeal to young people? Because that's where the action is. And that's where the advertisers will pay the most money. And older people were viewed as set in their ways. They already had their brands. They were frugal. Remember, that was a generation that had grown up in the shadow of the Depression. And so they were not interesting. Flash forward to today. We have 70% of all the wealth in Europe and in the United States is held by people over 50. And they are active buyers of luxury cars, of travel vacations, of gifts for their grandchildren, of skin creams, I mean, vitamin supplements, you know, kind of anything, you know, financial services, anything you might imagine. And they're also a different breed of 60 or 70-year-old in that we've lived through so many changes that the idea that there's a new technology or a new software or there might be a new product to keep me healthier, I'm open to that, and most of us are. So, unfortunately, the media has still got this sort of habit, which is we got to appeal to young people. That's our primary. And what are the topics? What are the issues? And I was asked by a senior executive of a major corporation a few years ago, if you could target young people or older adults, which would you pick? And I said, wrong question. Why not appeal to both? And it may be that some of your programming appeals to the 20-year-olds and some of your program appeals to the 70-year-olds, but why feel that you can only go after one piece of the puzzle? And so partly when I got the invitation from you, Pete, I thought, well, look at this. Here's a guy that's doing exactly what I've been speculating about. By the way, I'm going to give you another example. I only have a teeny little bit of knowledge about Great Britain, although I did spend many years advising the chairman of HSBC back when it was Sir John Bond. So I was back and forth to London almost every month for years. Back in the 1950s, there was a Brit named Roger Bannister, who was a medical student and also a runner. And at that moment in history, it was believed that humans would never break the four-minute mile. It's just not possible. And then Bannister broke the four-minute mile. And within months, people all over the world started running faster. And I think that's a good metaphor. I think as we see more 62-year-olds playing in rock bands, more 80-year-olds running companies, more 73-year-olds falling in love, more 90-year-olds learning new things. It gives us a whole new perspective as to what's possible. I'll give you one other example on this. About 20 or so years ago, John Glenn, the astronaut and the senator, announced he was going to be going back up into space at 77. And I knew Glenn, not well, but we had testified before the Senate together. And he was a tough guy. And I watched him in his first interviews, and all the reporters were saying, "Don't you think you're a little too old for this? And, you know, what if you have to go to the bathroom and you go in your pants? And what if your head blows up? And why don't you give this opportunity to young people?" And Glenn turned back to these reporters and he said, "Hey, just because I'll be 77 doesn't mean I still don't have dreams." And man, that really got my attention, because I think we think in what was previously a youthful world that you have dreams one time when you're young, and you either fulfill them or you don't. I think what Glenn was giving us insight into is, if we're going to live longer lives, there may be time for new dreams, new possibilities, new ideas, new relationships, new purpose. And I think that that's the era into which we're heading. And I sure wish that the media weren't so, "How do we catch the youth vote?" which is important, but also, how do we answer some of these fundamental questions that are going to put our economy or our families into disarray if we don't dream up a 21st or 22nd century version of six generations alive at once, where longevity has become commonplace.
Well, again, it's been absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for being my guest. Many thanks to Gen for a really fascinating chat. Do take a look at his back catalogue of books and the website agewave.com. Well, that's all we have time for on this edition. Hope you've enjoyed it, and you'll join me again soon for some more Dementia Talk right here on the D Word Podcast.